Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here for the conversation, Hawaii Talks, on this Aloha Friday, the 5th of December. This Sunday, we will mark 84 years since the attack on Pearl Harbor. Today, we're bringing you a show highlighting stories about World War II that you may not be familiar with. We peer into archival images of Hawaii during wartime and meet four shuffleboard pilots in a new book of historical fiction. We salute a Marine story of Old Glory and being a prisoner of war in Japan. We also bring you a story about the Battle of Guam that you don't hear much about. Plus, we talk to a researcher exploring previously unmapped World War II shipwrecks in Chuuk in Micronesia. Tune to the conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. A slice of life in Hawaii during World War II, that's what Dee and Jack Buckingham collected as part of a new installment in the national book series, Images of America. More than 150 archival photographs paint a nuanced picture of military and civilian life in the territory. It might come as a surprise to see a photograph of Mary Kawenapukui helping with a top-secret effort to weave camouflage nets on one of Oahu's beaches strung with barbed wire to prevent a potential invasion. The conversation's Maddie Bender spoke with the Buckinghams about their research process and some of the lesser-known stories of the war in Hawaii. Jack is a retired Marine Corps pilot and a docent at the Pearl Harbor Aviation Museum. Dee is an author and former librarian. Dee starts us off.
I am a librarian by trade, probably have 15 to 20 years of research on women in World War II, so I had a head start on the book. And as far as the images, what I wanted, in terms of choosing photographs, it's kind of split between me and Jack. He did the military part, I did the civilian part. So I wanted to make visible how the war impacted women and children. I wanted them to see women digging trenches at the schools and the teachers. I wanted them to be aware of the fact that this was a war zone, that there was a possibility of land invasion. It was clear and present danger that people were evacuated, that military wives were evacuated. So I wanted those pictures. I wanted the more emotional pictures, the pictures of the 442nd, and my favorite picture is a picture of Sergeant Kiyama, and he's returning from war, and his father is hugging him, and I think that actually won a Pulitzer Prize, and it shows everything. As a parent, here's this older Japanese man in tears holding this very young man coming home.
I imagine that half the challenge was just narrowing down what images were going to go in the book. So, Jack, maybe, what were some of the close calls, or what did you have a ton of photos of?
Well, fortunately, the War Records Depository has literally thousands of pictures from that era. As you point out, it became a function of what can we use or what can't we use. I thought maybe I was going to wipe out my hard drive storing them all, but we probably looked at and copied from the archive well over 1,500 pictures to acquire the ones we used. And then it just became a function of Dee and I sitting down with these photos that are in the public domain, fortunately, and then determining this one versus this one. And again, for us, it was to try to get the greater impact in terms of people and life here, not so much the military look, but the impact of it for them.
And I will say, choosing the photographs, Jack and I are married over 50 years. It did not help. He chose the cover photo, and the cover photo is of a child at McKinley High School, right?
Yep.
And there's a tank and a soldier sitting on the tank at McKinley High School. And so, of course, I didn't like that one. I didn't like several that we chose. So it is a good combination because we have his perspective as a man, mine as a woman, and somehow also the editors at Arcadia selected some. But the selection was really hard because we were limited to, what, 152 in this book?
I think so.
And there were so many that I wanted to just put in. So I have a Substack. Beaches, Brothels, and Barbed Wire. And I've used a lot of that material and put those photos in because so many good ones.
Dee shared her favorite photograph. What is yours, Jack?
I think, interestingly, a photograph of a Navy photographer who was the only photographer in the Pacific who was dive qualified at the time. And he became the one responsible for going into the ships, the sunken ships, and photographing the interiors. And I think in the picture of him, you get a sense of the impact of that on him. Hmm. He went into the Oklahoma, which had 429 sailors and Marines entombed. And so I think you can imagine from the look on his face just what he might have experienced by doing that.
And that point you raise, I think, is a good one and emblematic of all the photos in here, that it's not just telling a story in the photograph itself,
right. But
the image has to in some way also speak to broader context or this larger arc that you as the curators essentially are having to put together. How about, I'm on page 32, and maybe Dee, I can have you explain what we're seeing in this photo, the Christmas lights on King Street.
The photo was taken the night before the attack. And it was a boom year for business because there were so many sailors here. There was such a buildup. There were so many soldiers here that the Chamber of Commerce was just dancing. And then the next day, everything goes dark, totally dark.
The thing about losing your lights and going, you know, doing blackouts, that happened along each of the coasts on the mainland as well. However, for the territory, every single house, every single building, everything was blacked out for a significant period of time. And the Christmas tree ship did not arrive that year. So people had no Christmas trees. The Christmas tree ship returned to Oregon and was damaged, but the Christmas trees were all floating all along with turkeys and everything else that were all intended for the Christmas holidays here in Hawaii.
Yeah, and the Christmas toys, all of those bikes and dolls and everything, they were still on the West Coast in California because the ships that were supposed to bring them all here now have munitions and they have troops, and they weren't going to put bicycles on those. So the kids got impacted severely for Christmas that year.
Yeah, and I hadn't known that that was one of the origins of using Norfolk pine trees Christmas trees because of that history of the Christmas tree ship. And one more I just wanted to point out, you have the mugshot of Otto Kuhn, who was the only person in Hawaii convicted of spying for the Japanese. Yep. Talk about the decision to highlight that photo.
One of the things that I remain concerned with, even when I talk to the folks at the museum, is that there is, I think, a tendency on the part of everyone who is not from here to presume that because we have such a large Japanese ancestral population, that was a source of spying, and that's why they had such success in their attack. And it certainly wasn't the case. You know, yes, there were spies, but they were typically professional spies who came from Japan for that purpose. Kuhn, we wanted to represent, they didn't convict any Japanese for spying. It was a German, ironically. We wanted to help highlight the fact that 99.999% of the Japanese ancestral folks here were at least, if not truly loyal to the United States, were not opposed to the United States and its way of life.
We've been hearing from Dee and Jack Buckingham about their book of images of World War II Hawaii. Dee shares that Otto Kuhn used to live in a pink stucco bungalow in Lanihai, known for its parties. After the break, we'll hear from Dee about another book she's written, this one a historical fiction novel about the woman's air raid defense. Stay with us.
Thank you. Support for HPR comes from HMSA. For over 87 years, providing health plans to the people of Hawaii with a commitment to supporting the health and well-being of the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
On the next Radiolab.
Out of like 6,000 some species of mammals, they thought we were the only ones.
The medical mystery.
We were just freaks.
Of menopause.
It was assumed that human females were the only species that went through it.
And then scientists learned about
Granny.
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 The matriarch of all matriarchs.
Hunter-in-chief.
The one in charge.
These females are the repositories for ecological wisdom.
That's on the next Radiolab.
Beginning Saturday morning at 11.
Support for HPR comes from Sarah at the Renaissance Honolulu Hotel and Spa, serving Mediterranean-inspired cuisine, featuring a bar and lounge, offering cocktails and small plates. Reservations at opentable.com.
Welcome back to The Conversation. Let's pick up our interview with Jack and Dee Buckingham. Dee is the author of a new book out this weekend about the WARD, the Women's Air Raid Defense in Hawaii. They were known as the Shuffleboard Pilots. They were tasked with plotting the positions of aircraft, a top secret mission formed in response to the Pearl Harbor attack. Dee Buckingham's book comes out December 7th and is titled Codename Rascal. She told The Conversation's Maddie Bender about the idea that had been stuck in her head for decades.
I started researching women in World War II when Nanette Parnell did a lecture on civilians who were killed. I didn't know that that happened. And she talked about Gussie Arnalis. I have Gussie in the book. And Gussie lives in Kalihi. And Jack, what do you call the anti-aircraft, the shrapnel that fell down?
Yeah,
what
was aircraft fire.
It was.
They were poorly fused. And they were fused for gunnery, not aerial gunnery.
Yes.
And so they came back down and struck the ground and exploded.
Almost all the people who were killed by that, not by, I think there was just one exception, not by any Japanese. And I thought, oh my God, how does she get up in the morning? I'm a mom. She's just buried her two daughters. And then I went on and then I read about Mrs. Hirasaki at the Cherry Blossom Saimin stand. And Mrs. Hirasaki, husband died, 48 years old. Two sons, 6 and 8 years old, died. And her daughter, 2-year-old Shirley, dies. They were in a Saimin stand in Chinatown, and there were CYO boxers in there, young kids, nobody over 20 years old, and I think 7 or 8 of them died, all at the same site. Again, the question is, how did she get up the next morning? How did she do it? So I started researching women of World War II. That ended up to be a column in a now-defunct newspaper. And then I tried to pitch a nonfiction book about women in World War II there was no interest. And I started interviewing even more and more women. Actually, Jack introduced me to Kathy Cooper, was one of the charter wards. And then I was introduced to Ruth Cope through work at the USS Arizona. And I found out about those women. It took me 20 years to get over the hero worship. I couldn't write a book because the book was terrible. It was just one big hero worship. This is my 9th book. And so I had to develop the skill to turn them into fictional people with flaws. And at 75 years old, I was finally mature enough to do it. So that's how it started. And all I want is for people to just fall in love with my ladies.
The four of them, right? CJ, Eve,
Ruth, and Jane.
Do you see yourself in any of them? Or do you see yourself in all of them?
Jack, keep quiet. They were intentional. There were four facets of the society. So Eve was there to show what the affluent Caucasian society, she lives in Nu'uanu, she's very smallly, vaguely modeled after the Walker family. Her mom, Uma Walker, was actually the woman who General Davidson called to find out about, to get women to be recruited for the Rascals. It's all in the book, thinly veiled as fiction. So I don't think a lot of mainland people understood the definite segregation between affluent mainland Hawaii and the rest. So she's to point that out. And then we have Jane, who I don't know anybody like Jane. She's a Texas rancher's daughter, becomes a pilot, marries badly, one of her flight students. But she represents the women in transition, the women who have to make a choice between their marriage and a career, where she, as an outstanding pilot, wanted to serve her country. And then who do we have? Ruth. I'd like Ruth to be my friend. Ruth is a third-generation Navy officer's wife. I have been a military wife for 23 years, and so I wanted to give voice to what our lives are and what they were like during that time. And she's conflicted because there is a definite role that was required to be a woman at that time. And there were so many small things you didn't realize about the 1940s military. Her daughter dies, and she's buried at Schofield. And there is a baby cemetery at Schofield, and you see all of these tombs of infants to like 5 years old. So these children died, and then their parents were transferred someplace else, and they leave the body of that child behind. And it's just a small insight into what it was like. And she has a problem of loyalties and definition as what is mother, what is wife, what is woman. Then there's CJ, who's my problem child.
CJ is my problem child.
CJ is the main narrator. She is a feisty Italian-American coming straight out of New Jersey, and she's a Columbia University grad. She comes to Hawaii December 5th to marry her love of her life, a Marine lieutenant. She thinks she's going to set Hawaii on fire, and she is arrogant enough to think there are no journalists of her quality here. And of course, December 7th, that's all changed.
What would you want listeners to take away about your book, but about the ward, really? Because it's a love letter to the Women's Air Raid Defense. Yeah, there's probably so much that you would have wanted to ask these women had their contributions been known and celebrated.
It's interesting because at the time, they were considered society girls who didn't do very much, and they were just pushing around little things on a board. And a lot of them were. And during the wartime, not now, but during the wartime, they were underrated by those people who knew what they were doing. Now, I think there's so many of that generation who don't tell you what they did. I don't understand why. It's also because people my generation didn't ask, and that's our fault. What I want them to take away from this book about the ward in particular is it was the first organization of women that were given secret clearance. They actually plotted what was going on. They were the ones who called the air raids. And that's a big responsibility because it shut down all of the businesses. It shut down everything, transportation, communication, everybody goes inside. I want the readers to just really fall in love with them and respect them. And when reading the book, if there's anything that piques your curiosity, Roosevelt High School was bombed. Well, okay, was it really bombed? You know, go look it up. I did play with a few things, but there's so many facts in there that, I don't know. I wish I could sit next to the reader and pull her sleeve the whole time saying, wait, you see that line there? Well, that's really true. Let me tell you that story and then go on for half an hour. So I just want you to savor the book.
Dee and Jack Buckingham, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thank you.
We're hearing from Dee and Jack Buckingham. Together, they collected more than 150 archival images for the book World War II Hawaii. And Dee's historical fiction book, Codename Rascal, comes out this Sunday, December 7th. The first Japanese planes attacked the island of Guam just a few hours after the bombing of Pearl Harbor in 1941. The record says Guam's attack was on December 8th, but Guam is a day ahead because of the international dateline. As we look at lesser-known stories of World War II, we wanted to highlight a family story told to us by University of Hawaii scientist Patrick Cross. Cross's grandfather, a Marine, was taken prisoner of war during the invasion and occupation of Guam. We spoke with Cross last month. He told us there were hardships for his grandfather that came with being in two different POW camps in Japan over 4 years.
My grandfather, Major Donald Spicer, was the executive officer, or the XO, of the Marine Detachment on Guam when the Japanese attacked at the beginning of the war. So after a valiant but brief fight, they had to surrender. And he personally was at gunpoint forced to lower the American flag at the governor's palace in Guam, which had been their headquarters for the U.S. presence there in Guam. So he became a prisoner of war for the rest of the war, the entire war in Japan. But the emotional part of the story is that flag that they lowered in Guam, they were able to keep to themselves and keep hidden and under clothes or whatever, but hang on to it through the war, through all the miseries of the prison camps. And ultimately, my grandfather was able to, he requested and was granted the right to raise the American flag at Rokuroshi, which was the Japanese prison camp where he ended his war experience, although most of his time was spent at another camp called Zentsuji in another part of Japan.
And you were able to travel to Japan to go connect with that part of your family's history?
Yes. Interestingly, my son now lives in Japan with his Japanese wife in the Kobe, Osaka area. So we made a little day trip down to Zentsuji. It's just a few hours away. And there's actually still a modern-day Japanese Self-Defense Force base that's located there on the site of the where the prison camp had been. So yeah, we were able to visit. They have a little museum there that commemorates the World War II era. And there's some pictures of prisoners of war and stuff in books in their little back room. And we were welcomed quite enthusiastically by the curator, I guess you'd call her, of the museum. So yeah, that was really kind of emotional to be back on that site.
You mentioned that he was forced to take that flag down, and I guess they had kept hidden secret this symbol, right, this flag. And I understand that there is a book that was published. It was an account from an admiral about being in those prisoner of war camps, and it mentions your grandfather. And when I was reading it the other night, I was so surprised to see that they had his words included as part of this book about what it was like being forced to take the flag down and then raising it once they knew that the Americans came back. And so I'm going to ask you to read that, if you could.
Sure, yeah.
The book is called...
The book is called Captive of the Rising Sun. It's written by Don Giles Jr., who is the son of Don Giles Sr., who had been on Guam. He was the number two naval officer. My grandfather, he had requested the honor of raising that flag. And so here's what he said about that. He said, "And there, 45 months after I tasted the bitter dregs of humiliation, almost 4 years after I became the first U.S. Marine to strike our colors to an enemy, I was to raise the first American flag over the Japanese homeland. My feelings, therefore, as I reverently held the flag in my hands and proudly marched up the hill to the flagpole on September 2nd, 1945, are not difficult to imagine. With a final caress, I let that grand old flag slip through my fingers to flutter proudly over the Japanese homeland. As I gazed upward and saluted the stars and stripes, I swallowed hard, restraining my tears. After we were dismissed, I let them flow freely, laughing and crying at the same time as we milled about, wringing each other's hands. Every man was filled with the same surging emotions. Every man was holding on with his last ounce of strength, determined to prove that he came from fighting stock, which could not be beaten." That's it.
You know, it's so important to keep these stories alive. I was reading that I think one of the last social things that they had on the island was they were watching a football game, Army versus Navy. And of course, they were rooting for the Navy, and the Navy won. You just take for granted those kinds of things and the stories that bring it all back about what happened during the war and the attack. And so as you observe Veterans Day, I don't know, what do you want to convey to our listeners?
Oh, I'm a veteran myself, and so was my father, and we have an extended family history of service in the Marine Corps and in the Navy, primarily, with some Army guys back in the day as well. So Veterans Day always means a lot to me from a family perspective, but just as an American, it's, you know, service to our country has always meant a lot to me, and I particularly honor Veterans Day and Memorial Day for that reason, but obviously many of us Americans do.
I have to thank you for turning me onto this book because it does detail an account of my home island during the war and giving me context because I think of the war because of the attack on Pearl Harbor and the many stories that I've done with veterans, but then to get a glimpse of what it was like on that island because around the time that Hawaii was getting bombed, so was Guam. When you read his account of how that all came down, I'm very grateful to have the printed word and to see it from that point of view.
I think the key difference between Guam and Hawaii was that Guam was bombed around the same time as Hawaii, within hours. It was December 8th due to the dateline, but obviously what happened a couple days later was actual invasion of Guam by Japanese forces on land, which many thought in Hawaii would happen here as well. Unfortunately, it did not. But what the local people of Guam went through was pretty horrific. Yeah. And I think one of the things that comes out in this book and other accounts I've read is what a tight bond there was between the U.S. forces and the Chamorro people or the people of Guam in general. I visited Guam a few times myself, and I visited the governor's palace. And I have an inherent fondness for the Chamorro people because of what they went through together.
Yeah, and in this time and space, there is a buildup of the island just because of what's going on politically in the Indo-Pacific area. But it certainly is important to just stop and reflect on the many people whose lives were lost and whose lives were changed because of that war. So I certainly appreciate you bringing this book to my attention and the history that I didn't know.
Yes, you've inspired me to reread the book because some of the details are already getting fuzzy for me.
Anything else that you just want to share just about how things have changed?
Gosh, obviously things have changed pretty dramatically between the United States and Japan. They're among our best friends in the world. And I don't know. Geopolitically, there's obviously been night and day change for the better, obviously.
After learning your grandfather's story, like I said, I was so intrigued because these are stories you don't always hear about. There's so many stories, but when December 7th rolls around, right, we have the last veterans that make it over here pushing 100. So you always stop and think, but it's just amazing, like I said, piecing together that history.
There's not too many of them left, but I don't know. I think whether you had a relative who was taken prisoner or not, I did, but most did not. I think it's worth reading these sorts of accounts of what people went through at the hands of the Japanese, not to dig up old angers or anything, just to understand what people went through so we hopefully don't repeat those sorts of those things again. That story has meant a lot to me through my life. I wish I could have known my grandfather. He died just after I was born. I didn't get to know him. He did rise to the rank of colonel in the Marine Corps before retiring and unfortunately died in 1960.
That was Patrick Cross, whose grandfather, Donald Spicer, was a POW during World War II. Spicer's story can be found in the memoir of Rear Admiral Donald T. Giles titled Captive of the Rising Sun. If you're just joining in the conversation, we're highlighting lesser-known war stories as we mark the 84th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor. Guam is where they say America's day begins. Full disclosure, it's my original home island. In 1941, Japan seized Guam from the U.S. and controlled it for nearly 3 years. The U.S. took it back on July 21, 1944, Liberation Day. The military calls it W-Day. The 80th anniversary was celebrated last year, not just in Guam, but in communities from New Jersey to Indiana to California. While the 80th anniversary of D-Day grabbed international headlines, the smaller Battle of Guam was overshadowed. I happened to be there last summer, and these days, the island is anxiously awaiting the return of Japanese tourists. They have forgiven what the Japanese Imperial Army did decades ago. Survivors have shared brutal stories about massacres and death marches. Our story begins in church. The choir sings a Chamorro hymn. Most islanders are Catholic. After all, Spanish explorers claimed and ruled Guam for 300 years. This afternoon's service in the cathedral in the capital of Agaña honored those who survived the Japanese occupation. No ifs and buts about it, Guam's history is deeply imprinted with Mass and, well, the military, whether it be Spanish, the U.S., or the Japanese. The sermon that day was about forgiveness.
In our native language, to say thank you or to be appreciative of one, we say, Sidzuos Maasi. As we gather today, I hope that we are mindful of that, which literally translates to be God's mercy or the mercy of God. Sidzuos Maasi. As we once again embark on this journey during this liberation celebration, we have a lot to be thankful for. Many of our people who have died, who have suffered during the war, many of the men and women in the military services have given of their lives, and many today who continue to endure the atrocity and the trauma of the memories of the war. We are here today to say thank you to God and thank you to one another.
One of the survivors in attendance was 90-year-old Bernadita Perez, my aunt. She shared that one of the most brutal accounts was from a 12-year-old girl who survived a beheading by the Japanese. Beatrice Flores Emsley would tell her story to Congress. She heard the cries of 45 Chamorro boys and men who Japanese soldiers tied to trees and then cut their heads off. With a gash to her neck, she and a young man who was bayoneted 5 times crawled to a nearby house and hid in an outdoor Spanish oven. My aunt said that home was my grandfather's. The stories go on. Guam's governor, Lou Leon Guerrero, had a relative who was a medic who helped the many injured in the bloody battle. And the theme this year, Peace for Us Always, resonates loudly.
And may the words, Todo y tiempo y paz parejita, echo through the ages, a reminder of our commitment to peace today and always. Sidzuos Maasi, and God bless Guam.
During Mass, I happened to notice that in the communion line that day was Admiral Sam Paparo, head of Indo-PACOM. I would learn later about his ties to this place. His grandfather was a Seabee, the construction arm of the Navy, who had served in Guam. In a ceremony that followed Mass later that evening, Paparo shared he grew up hearing stories of his grandfather's time there.
I was mesmerized by the beauty and the culture of this special place. The Lord works in mysterious ways. And here in this special place, I had the great honor today of visits all throughout the island. Naval Base Guam, Task Force Talon, the Theater High Altitude, Defense Site, Camp Blas, Anderson Air Base.
Paparo talked of inspecting the buildup of the island. It controls about a fourth of Guam. It is soon to be home to thousands of Marines as the U.S. shuts down its base in Okinawa. It is also home to one of the most advanced anti-missile defense systems, Terminal High Altitude Aerial Defense, or THAAD.
The attack involved over 59,000 service members and lasted over 21 days through August 10th of 1944 at the cost of 3,000 U.S. service members killed, 6,000 wounded. And the attack was successful because of the close-knit integration of soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, Coast Guardsmen fighting together.
Billions of federal dollars are being spent in Guam, and while there are fears about the island being the tip of the spear for the U.S. forces and a target, Paparo said this.
To defend Guam, to defend America, that this shall never, ever happen again. Some say that this is the forward edge of America, but it's not. This is not the forward edge of America. There is a defense in depth, U.S. 7th Fleet, forward of this place, defending. U.S. 5th Air Force, U.S. 7th Air Force, U.S. 8th Army is forward here. Guam will never, ever be exposed again. I bring a message of hope. I bring a message of steel. I bring a message of confidence that Guam will always be a priority. We have our best warfighters here defending because Guam is the homeland. Preventing conflict, deterring conflict is our highest duty. The theme of this year's liberation, peace for us always, as the governor has said, is so absolutely fitting. The joint force is committing to a lasting friendship, to family, and the defense of Guam so that future generations will never, ever have to endure the tragedy that the Mañana suffered 80 years ago. We have confidence, we have hope to uphold for peace for us always. Viva Guam, viva America. God bless Guam, God bless America. My thanks to all.
And like the perfectly timed bells of the cathedral, on cue the Marine Band chimes in, the pomp and circumstance that comes with military ceremonies. Patriotism and peace, whether at the podium or in the pews, the faithful want to believe Indo-PACOM's word is good, and they may pray it is. Sidzuis Maasi, that was part of a commemoration that took place to mark the 80th anniversary of the liberation of Guam from the Japanese during World War II. The battle began on July 21, 1944, and lasted until August 10th.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Energy, assisting local businesses in reducing energy waste. Learn more about lighting upgrades available through February at hawaiienergy.com/lighting.
This is Ira Glass of This American Life. Do you know our show? Okay, well, either way, I'm going to tell you about it. We make stories, old-fashioned stories that hopefully pull you in at the beginning with funny moments and feelings and people in surprising situations, and then you just want to find out what is going to happen and cannot stop listening. That's right. I'm talking about stories that make you miss appointments and ignore your loved ones. This American Life.
Beginning Saturday at noon.
You're tuned to Hawaii Public Radio, the most listened to stations in Hawaii. On the air, on our mobile app, or online at hawaiipublicradio.org. Voted the best news site in Hawaii.
We close out today's Hanaho show highlighting lesser-known stories of World War II by diving into Chuuk Lagoon. Payback for Pearl Harbor. That's how the lagoon became a watery graveyard for scores of shipwrecks and Japanese aircraft. The Micronesian islands of Chuuk, or Truk, had become a key strategic seaplane and submarine camp for Japan during World War II. The U.S. considered dropping an atomic bomb, but instead relied on conventional bombs, nearly 7,000 tons worth. When Operation Hailstone was all over, some 5,000 Japanese soldiers and 1,000 islanders were killed, 400 aircraft destroyed, and 50 ships sunk. A grant from the American Battlefield Protection Program has enabled researchers to map a group of sunken ships that were never previously surveyed. William Jeffrey is an archaeology professor at the University of Guam who spearheaded an expedition to explore the wrecks and, maybe more importantly, to include the islanders' stories about this battle in the Pacific. We spoke with him when this work began in 2024.
Chuuk's people have been living there for about 2,000 years. And have had several colonial rulers from the Spanish, the Germans, Japanese, and the Americans, mainly during the Japanese period, some from 1914 to 1945, that had the biggest impact on Chuuk's people, mainly because of the build-up to the war. The war really started when the bombing started in February 1944. The Americans regarded Chuuk, or Truk as it's called then, as the equivalent to their Pearl Harbor. So it was seen as a very important strategic base that on their road back to sort of pushing the Japanese back into Japan, they wanted to neutralize the base. So they thought of dropping an atomic bomb in Chuuk, June 1944, but they found that the bombing that they'd done in February neutralized it fairly well. So they didn't do that, thankfully. But they sent in wave after wave. It was actually 10 times more aircraft than the Japanese sent into Pearl Harbor and bombed it in February 44, then again in April, May 44, and then subsequently for the next 3.5 years from B-24, B-29s and the Marshall Islands to sort of keep it neutral because the Americans were wanting to fight and push the Japanese out of the Philippines and then back into Japan. They wanted to neutralizes the big base that they called Truk Lagoon. So it was promoted as a payback in all the press after the bombing as a payback to Pearl Harbor. And the Chuukis were greatly impacted. Many people lost their lives. They were pushed away from their homes, their home islands. You know, they lost their land. They lost their cultural identity because their land is essentially part of their cultural identity.
You know, we share that feeling here in Hawaii as well as it is for many Pacific Islanders. So during that time, I'm reading that there are 1,000 Chuukis who died and 5,000 Japanese troops?
Yes, that's correct. There's probably about 40,000 troops, Japanese troops and civilians and construction workers, and about 10,000 Chuukis living there at the time. Many of the Japanese, about 4,000, died on the ships at least. So about 50 to 60 ships, although around the whole of the lagoon, outside about 110 ships altogether during the war were sunk in and around Truk. And it was the bombing in February and then May 1944 was the greatest merchant ship loss by the Japanese up until that time in the war. It remains one of the most significant loss of merchant ships. The Japanese were aware that the Americans were looking at bombing because they sent scout planes over a few days before. So they pushed their big battleships and their navy ships back to Palau. But the merchant ships were still unloading. They were sort of ferrying cargo to Chuuk or on its way to Rabaul or other places down south for their sort of guarding against the American fighting. So there were many, many merchant ships and sailors and soldiers coming there to help defend the base that went down with the ships and equipment, cargo, planes that went down. Over 350 aircraft were destroyed, and only a handful of those had actually been found. So there's many more of those that could be found, you know, along with the missing in action people, that the pilots went down with them. And there's a number of American and Japanese groups still looking for those planes for possibly that could find human remains with them.
Well, this project that you're undertaking, you're going to be surveying 3 new shipwrecks that we don't know much about?
Most of the big ships are known in Chuuk Lagoon, but I came across my research many years ago, about three smaller ships, so they're a bit away from the main concentration of shipwrecks. So I want to look for them, and that'll give us an idea of the flora and fauna been there for some time, whereas the other shipwrecks visited by people and by tourists, and sometimes they interfere with what's remaining. Dynamite fishing has been carried out on the shipwrecks because, as I said, they carry lots of munitions and lots of stores as well. And so dynamite fishing has been carried out, and that stripped the corals off of a lot of these ships and impacted the fauna, the fish too. So to find these new shipwrecks, it would be quite interesting to see, you know, what's on them, because part of our work is looking at the marine biology work and the ecology, the broader sort of part of the biology of these shipwrecks. Because one of the things the FSM national government are looking at maybe nominating this area for World Heritage listing, and they want to look at not just the cultural aspect, but the natural flora and fauna. Many of the divers that have been coming there for years, since, you know, in the 1970s, say it's a wonderland of flora and fauna. It is. It's just a beautiful place to dive. 30 degrees Celsius down to, 40 metres, 150 feet or so, 28 degrees maybe the coldest Celsius, not Fahrenheit, so it's still pretty warm, 90 degrees Fahrenheit. So it's clear water, and with all this flora and fauna, it's just a fantastic, beautiful place, apart from the historical, the war remains. And, you hear of divers coming back and feeling quite teary about it because, you go there and it's still, ships are sitting upright. You can get the emotion of, you see all the sake bottles or beer bottles, and you swim inside and see the cabins, and there used to be some human remains there that you could see, but most of them have been taken away now and had the ceremonies, so you don't see much of them there. But you can get a strong sense of association with the war and the people when you dive the ships.
Yeah, I mean, it is a watery graveyard, and you have to give it the respect that it deserves, for the lives that were lost deep in the ocean. And so, mapping out these areas where there's little known, it just helps our knowledge about that area.
The main things we're doing, while we work on the shipwrecks, we're concentrating a fair bit on the land, on the terrestrial, because the 18, 19 high volcanic islands inside the lagoon, and they all had military remains on them, and many of them were bombed. But the main island, Tonawos, that had something like 1,200 Japanese buildings on it during the war. Seaplane base, repair base, a floating dock, submarine base. There was five airstrips in Chuuk altogether. A little island nearby, Eton, was one of its major airstrips there. So there was a lot of infrastructure built on these islands. So there used to be, when divers come and dive the wrecks, that they could then go off to Tonawos and look at this. But during COVID, things shut down and no one came. There were no dive tourism in Chuuk at that time. And the jungle took over. And the mayor, working closely with the mayor, Tonawos Cradovan Hasek, and also runs the Blue Lagoon Resort, he wants to try and revive, this aspect of the tourism, the cultural tourism. And it gives people on the island sort of a connection too, with people coming there, and they can get involved with the tourists, and they can help each other out. There's many also Japanese tourists that go there and pay their respects to their fallen ancestors. There's memorials associated with the brother of the Emperor Hirohito, who went there in 1928. There's memorials to Japanese people. So many sort of tourists used to go there, and not so many now. And so we want to sort of help revive that aspect of it. But we also want to, which is very important, we want to say in our interpretation how the Chuukis, the traditional sites, the sacred sites, the spiritual sites, were impacted by the war, and not to leave them out of this sort of context. When they do this sort of thing, they look at the Japanese and American, or maybe Australian sites, if there are, the protagonist stuff. But they don't think about, what about local people? They were greatly impacted by the war, and it wasn't their sort of war. So innocent sort of people. So we want to bring that out in our work, and that's on the islands. Not so much in the water, although there's sort of natural reef that would have sacred connection, traditional connection that we could bring out as well, but mostly on the island. So it's a combination of the underwater shipwreck work, the marine biology, finding some new sites, and this sort of what's on the islands, Japanese sites, and and the Chuukis traditional sites that we want to portray. This is a holistic heritage from World War II, not just one or two aspects.
That was William Jeffrey, archaeologist with the University of Guam. He has been mapping three previously unknown shipwrecks from World War II in Chuuk Lagoon. At that time, Chuuk was taken over by Japan, where they established a seaplane and a submarine base, which was bombed by the U.S. in retaliation for the Pearl Harbor attack. Jeffrey says when he arrived there in 2001 from Australia, he realized that the stories of the islander perspectives were overlooked. He hopes this research will make that point of view more widely known to those who visit Micronesia. The project was completed at the end of last year, and now those stories, Chuuk stories, can live on. That does it for today's special showcase of overlooked World War II stories as we mark the 84th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor. You can listen back to the conversation on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. The show is also available as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. Our program is produced by Maddie Bender, Lillian Song, and D.W. Gibson, with support from Savannah Harriman Pope and the HBR Digital team. The Backyard Quiz theme written for us by John DeMello. Our theme music courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up the conversation.